Thanks for tuning in. Excuse me while I burp up some more turkey. Ooh, oh, God. Hope you had a good holiday. Glad to see that you survived the, Black Thursday and Cyber Monday and this and that. What a bunch of hogs, not right. But did you have fun with your family? I hope so. Family and friends, however you did that particular holiday. We have something right here at the top of the program. By the way, I think we're going to have Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight, so stick around for that. I haven't done one of those for a while. There was a report issued today by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And as far as I know, it's gotten no coverage whatsoever. Maybe it'll be in tomorrow's New York Times. I have no idea, but this is astonishing. It was John Kerry is the chairman of that committee. And as reported by the Straits Times in Singapore and the Guardian of the UK, which is where you have to go sometimes for news, you damn sure can't rely on American media anymore, that's for sure, to tell you the truth or tell you anything. Except about Tiger Woods and whether or not he's got a girlfriend. Jesus Christ almighty, can you believe that story? Oh, my God. And the attention paid to it, right? Anyway, the report indicates that, contrary to what these Republican scumballs have been saying,
well, it's Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton should have killed him, should have killed bin Laden back in 96. Oh, wait, wasn't that before 2001? Yeah, it was. Okay. Donald Rumsfeld had the chance when he was U.S. Defense Secretary in December 2001 to make sure that bin Laden was killed or captured and deliberately let him slip through his hands.
So for you right-wing bastards, there's not enough pecan pie and pumpkin pie to mellow me out. You right-wing sons of bitches, I am so sick of you. It was your killer boy, Donald Rumsfeld, who has put us in this position. Your killer boy, huh? You know, part of the administration that allowed the whole 9/11 thing to happen. That entire administration. And Rumsfeld, of course, was the chief Jack the Ripper. It was Donald Rumsfeld whose blood of every single dead American drenches his $6,000 sport coat. Son of a bitch. Oh, I'm angry. I had 4 days off. I'm angry. The report by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is damning, oh, cute, of the way George Bush's administration conducted the aftermath of its bombing campaign in Afghanistan. The report says that the Bush crime family lost what amounted to, or blew what amounted to a lost opportunity. The report says that as a result of allowing the Qaeda leader to flee from his Tora Bora stronghold into Pakistan, Americans were left more vulnerable to terrorism. And the foundations were laid for today's protracted Afghan insurgency. Oh, and as a postscript, it also lays the blame for the July 2005 London, England bombings on a failure to get the Al-Qaeda leaders at Tora Bora. So the people who were killed in the London bombing, their blood is all over this filthy pig Rumsfeld also. How do we have something like this break in the news today? And these crappy news organizations are talking about Tiger Woods and about this couple. If I see this couple on television one more time, who I realize that is an important story because it points out the utter failure, the miserable goddamn maniacs who are charged with guarding the president, how useless they are. Why the head of the Secret Service is still drawing a paycheck today is beyond me. Or is that a civil service job? Oh, okay. But those two stories, I am so sick of it. Meanwhile, did Charlie Gibson or the guy on NBC, did they lead tonight with the Senate releases a report that lays the blame and responsibility for everything that occurred in Afghanistan at the feet of Donald Rumsfeld? Of course not. Why do that? So what do? Well, you go to, I'm sure there are other news sources. I just happen to go to The Guardian in the UK and the Straits Times from Singapore for this. The report contains a massive evidence that points toward the near certainty certainty that bin Laden was in the Tora Bora district of the White Mountains in eastern Afghanistan, along with up to 1,500 of his most loyal fighters and bodyguards in late November 2001, shortly after the fall of Kabul. Further evidence, according to the report, came from al-Qaeda suspects detained at Guantanamo, and most authoritatively from the official history of the U.S. Special Operations Command, which confirms bin Laden's presence at Tora Bora. The report concludes, quote, Osama bin Laden's demise would not have erased the worldwide threat from extremists, but the failure to kill or capture him has allowed bin Laden to exert a malign influence over events in the region, end quote. Now, this flies in the face, of course, of what Benatar Bhutto, Benazir Bhutto, it's Pat Benatar, come on, Mike. Benazir Bhutto, what she said before she was assassinated by the CIA, and that was that bin Laden was dead. You know, you pay your money, you take your chances. Who knows what the hell is truth anymore? But I have a strong feeling that in November 2001, whatever has happened to him subsequent to that date, that bin Laden was alive and kicking. And Rumsfeld knew it. And Rumsfeld said, no, that's all right. Let it be. Now, of course, the Republican scum in this country are going to dismiss the report as a partisan work designed to deflect the current military troubles in Afghanistan away from President Obama and onto his predecessor. Isn't that what they always say? Isn't what these scum bastards always say? And then I read a report today that says 40% of registered Democratic voters are not going to the polls in 2010. Okay. You know what that means. Now, that was according to The Guardian of the UK. According to The Straits Times in Singapore, this report, of course, comes on the eve of Obama's preparation to announce this major escalation of the Afghan conflict. Now, in its ninth year, the report says, quote, the vast array of American military power, from sniper teams to the most mobile divisions of the Marine Corps and the Army, were kept on the sidelines. Instead, the U.S. command chose to rely on airstrikes and untrained Afghan militias to attack bin Laden and on Pakistan's loosely organized Frontier Corps. That was the name of the army, the Frontier Corps, to seal his escape route. Well, guess what? Didn't work. The report is entitled Tora Bora Revisited, How We Failed to Get Bin Laden and Why It Matters Today. The report says 100 American commandos were on the scene with their Afghan allies, and calls for reinforcements to launch an assault were rejected. We had people there. We had people risking their lives. We had people there who knew exactly where this whole nest of vermin was. And Rumsfeld turned down a request. The Secretary of Defense said, no, that's all right. No. Requests also were turned down for U.S. troops to block the mountain pass leading to sanctuary a few miles away in Pakistan. No, I don't think we'll do that either. The report says, quote, the decision not to deploy American forces to go after bin Laden or block his escape was made by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his top commander, General Tommy Franks. On around December 16th, 2 days after writing his will, bin Laden and an entourage of bodyguards walked unmolested out of Tora Bora and disappeared into Pakistan's unregulated tribal area. Analysts say he's still there today. Jesus God. So just a notice from Mike Malloy to you scum-sucking right-wing Republicans. And please don't ever call my... Kathy, I don't want these bastards on my program because they only last about 15 seconds and I have to dump them into the sewer. But for you right-wing bastards that listen to this program, you Republicans, you conservatives, what do you say? But I know you reject it, just like the theory of evolution and all the other stuff you reject, you crazy freaks. So there you have it. Now, I'm not saying this is new. You knew this. I knew this. When do we know this? We knew this, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? But it is key on the eve when President Barack Obama is about to announce 36,000 more Americans to go into this dung heap and try to save these tribal bastards who couldn't care less.
Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
It's 21 past the hour. Now, this afternoon on David Schuster's MSNBC program, and I can't think of his co-host, the female co-host, sorry about that, but Schuster had on Representative Maurice Hinchey, Democrat from New York, and Hinchey, who's from a Republican district, you know, I don't know why he's a Democrat that represents a Republican district, but, you know, that's not for me to try to figure out. But Hinchey gets on there and starts talking about this this report from his colleagues over on the Senate side that we just mentioned. And I want you to hear David Schuster, who up to this, I kind of appreciated his point of view. But if you saw this today, not only are you going to hear Schuster's incredulousness at hearing Hinchey say this, but if you could see the video, you would see Schuster give one of those, you know, whiskey tango fox looks on his face. Is it still Fox? I know they changed the radio. Oh well, one of the Foxtrot, Whiskey Tango Fox. I'm sleepy. Anyway, I want you to listen to this now. And also at the very end, this is 2 minutes long. At the very end, his co-host does one of those, okay, well, we're out of time things. Here, Representative Hinchey is trying to let the American people know, at least the ones who watch Schuster's program, all 300,000 of them, that the criminals who were the Bush crime family actually committed acts that could only be described as treason against his our own country. I mean, Jesus, God! But no, they had to move on to the Tiger Woods story. Or the couple who got into the dinner the other night. Damn them. Here's Maurice Hinchey.
But look what happened. Look what happened with regard to our invasion into Afghanistan, how we apparently intentionally let bin Laden get away, how we intentionally did not follow the Taliban and Al-Qaeda as they were escaping up into the northeast of Afghanistan over into the Pakistani border. That was done by the previous administration because they knew very well that if they would capture Al-Qaeda, there would be no justification for an invasion in Iraq.
Deliberately let Osama bin Laden get away? You think they deliberately let the head of Al-Qaeda get away right after the 9/11 attacks? You really believe that?
Oh, there's no question about that, because our military, the leader of the military operation in the United States, called back our military, called them back from going after the head of Al-Qaeda, because there was a sense
that they didn't want to capture him. You can accuse them of dropping the ball, of having an awful plan, and all of that would be justified, but to suggest that they would deliberately let Osama bin Laden get away so they could justify the war in Iraq, that will strike a lot of people as crazy.
I don't think it'll strike a lot of people as crazy. I think it'll strike a lot of people as being very accurate. And all you have to do is look at the facts of that set of circumstance, and you can see that's exactly what happened. When we went in there, when our military went in there, we could have captured them. We could have captured most of the Taliban, and we could have captured the Al-Qaeda. But we didn't. And we didn't because of the need felt by the previous administration and the previous head of the military, that need to attack Iraq, which was completely unjustified.
We're out of time, Congressman Hinchey. Thank you very much. And certainly we would love to have you on again to explore this more, as you can imagine.
Sure you would.
A lot of people, I'm sure, talking about.
Yeah, a lot of people, I'm sure, talking about. Yeah, okay, Congressman, we'd love to have you on. But you know what? We're out of time. We got to move over to this story about this couple that showed up unannounced and got into the dinner the other night. Also, then coming up, folks, stick around. We also have the Tiger Woods story. What really happened the other night when he crashed his Cadillac Escalade SUV into a fire hydrant and a bush? Was it really because he had a fight with his wife? Is it really because he's got a girlfriend? God damn, we'll get to that story, folks. Trust us. But in the meantime, this story, I'm sorry, we've already given it 4 minutes. That's enough. In fact, I just got something in my headphones saying we've given away too much money, too much time.
Our stories have got to be about money and power and falls from grace. And did you hear about the fine that the tennis star got for using the F word against the line judge last summer, spring, fall, winter? Who gives a damn? Well, I'm sorry, Representative Hinchey, but we have to move on now. We appreciate you coming on. I'm sure a lot of people are very interested in what you had to say. You bastards. And for the first time since I've been watching Mr. Schuster, he sounded like he worked for Fox News and his cohort. David Schuster, what a disappointment you're turning out to be. But then, you're just part of the establishment, so it doesn't really make any difference, right? Oh, my. All right, we have a break coming up here. When we come back, it might be Uncle Mike's story corner. So stick around, and we have miles to go before we sleep. Uncle Mike's Story Corner. If you are not familiar with Uncle Mike's Story Corner, we all gather together, usually in our pajamas, those real snuggly kind with the footies in them, and we listen while Uncle Mike tells the story. Tonight's story is entitled Addicted to Nonsense, and our author is Chris Hedges. Can you say Chris Hedges? That's nice. Will Tiger Woods finally talk to the police? Who will replace Oprah? Not that Oprah can ever be replaced, of course. And will Michaela and Tariq Salahi, the couple who crashed Barack Obama's first state dinner, command the hundreds of thousands of dollars they want for an exclusive television interview? Can Levi Johnston, father of former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's grandson, get his wish to be a contestant on Dancing with the Stars? The chatter that passes for news, the gossip that is peddled by the windbags on the airwaves, the noise that drowns out rational discourse, and the timidity and cowardice of what is left of the newspaper industry reflect our flight from collective into collective insanity. We stand on the cusp of one of the most seismic and disturbing dislocations in human history, one that is radically reconfiguring our economy, as it is the environment, and our obsessions revolve around the trivial and the absurd. What really matters in our lives, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the steady deterioration of the dollar, the mounting foreclosures, the climbing unemployment, the melting of the polar ice caps, and the awful reality that once the billions in stimulus money runs out next year, we will be bereft and broke. All of that doesn't fit into the cheerful happy talk that we mainline into our brains. We are enraptured by the revels of a dying civilization. Once reality shatters the airy edifice, we will scream and yell like petulant children to be rescued, saved, and restored to comfort and complacency. There will be no shortage of demagogues, including buffoons like Sarah Palin, who will oblige. We will either wake up to face our stark new limitations, to retreat from imperial projects and discover a new simplicity as well as a new humility, or we will stumble blindly toward catastrophe and neo-feudalism. Celebrity worship has banished the real from public discourse, and the adulation of celebrity is pervasive. The frenzy around political messiahs or the devotion of millions of viewers to Oprah is all part of the yearning to see ourselves in those we worship. We seek to be like them. We seek to make them like us. If Jesus and the book The Purpose-Driven Life won't make us a celebrity, then Tony Robbins or positive psychologists or reality television will. We are waiting for a cue to walk on stage and be admired and envied, to become known and celebrated. Nothing else in life counts. We yearn to stand before the camera, to be noticed and admired. We build pages of social networking sites devoted to presenting our image to the world. We seek to control how others think of us. We define our worth solely by our visibility. We live in a world where not to be seen, in some sense, is to not exist. We pay lifestyle advisors to help us look and feel like celebrities, to build around us the set for the movie of our own life. Martha Stewart constructed her financial empire when she wasn't engaged in insider trading, telling women how to create a set design for the perfect home. The realities within the home, the actual family, the relationships, are never addressed. Appearances make everything whole. Plastic surgeons, fitness gurus, diet doctors, therapists, life coaches, interior designers, and fashion consultants all, in essence, promise to make us happy, to make us celebrities. And happiness comes, we are assured, with how we look, with the acquisition of wealth and power, or at least the appearance of it. Glossy magazines like Town and Country cater to the absurd pretensions of the very rich to be celebrities. They are photographed in expensive designer clothing inside the lavishly decorated set pieces that are their homes. The route to happiness is bound up in how skillfully we present ourselves to the world. We not only have to conform to the dictates of this manufactured vision, but we also have to project an unrelenting optimism and happiness. Hedonism and wealth are openly worshipped on Wall Street as well as on such shows as The Hills, Gossip Girl, Sex in the City, My Super Sweet 16, and The Real Housewives of whatever bourgeois burg happens to be in vogue. The American oligarchy, 1% of whom control more wealth than the bottom 90% combined, they are the characters we most envy and watch on television. They live and play in multi-million dollar mansions. They marry models or professional athletes. They are chauffeured in stretch limos. They rush from fashion shows to movie premieres to fabulous resorts. They have surgically enhanced perfect bodies and are draped in designer clothes that cost more than some people make in a year. This glittering life is held before us like a beacon. This life, we are told, is the most desirable, the most gratifying, and this is the life we want. Greed is good, we believe, because one day, through our acquisitions, we will become the elite. So let the rest of the bastards suffer. The working class, comprising tens of millions of struggling Americans, are locked out of television's gated community. They are mocked, even as they are tantalized by the lives of excess. And they watch on the screen in their living rooms. Almost none of us will ever attain these lives of wealth and power. Yet we're told that if we want it badly enough, if we believe sufficiently in ourselves, we too can have everything. We are left, when we can't add up these impossible lifestyles as our own, with feelings of inferiority and worthlessness. We've failed where others have succeeded. We consume these countless lies daily. We believe the false promises that if we spend more money, if we buy this brand or that product, if we vote for this candidate, we will be respected, envied, powerful, loved, and protected. The flamboyant lives of celebrities and the outrageous characters on television, movies, professional wrestling, and sensational talk shows are peddled to us, promising to fill up the emptiness in our own lives. Celebrity culture encourages everyone to think of themselves as potential celebrities, as possessing unique, if unacknowledged, gifts. Faith in ourselves, in a world of make-believe, is more important than reality. Reality, in fact, is dismissed and shunned as an impediment to success, a form of negativity. The New Age mysticism and pop psychology of television personalities and evangelical pastors, along with the array of self-help bestsellers penned by motivational speakers, psychiatrists, and business tycoons, peddle this fantasy. Reality is condemned in these popular belief systems as the work of Satan, as defeatist, as negativity, or as inhibiting our inner essence and power. Those who question, those who doubt, those who are critical, those who are able to confront reality, along with those who grasp the hollowness and danger of celebrity culture, are condemned for their pessimism or intellectualism. The illusionists who shape our culture and who profit from our incredulity hold up the gilded cult of us. Popular expressions of religious belief, personal empowerment, corporatism, political participation, and self-definition argue that all of us are special, entitled, and unique. All of us, by tapping into our inner reserves of personal will and undiscovered talent, of visualizing what we want, can achieve, and deserve to achieve, happiness, fame, and success. This relentless message cuts across ideological lines. This mantra has seeped into every aspect of our lives. We are all entitled to everything. And because of this self-absorption and self-delusion, we have become a country of childlike adults who speak and think in the inane gibberish of popular culture. I spent 2 years traveling the country to write a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. I visited former manufacturing towns where for many the end of the world is no longer an abstraction. Many have lost hope. Fear and instability have plunged the working class into profound personal economic despair and, not surprisingly, into the arms of demagogues and charlatans of the radical Christian right who offer a belief in magic, miracles, and the fiction of a utopian Christian nation. Unless we rapidly re-enfranchise these dispossessed workers, insert them back into the economy, unless we give them hope, these demagogues will rise up to take power. Time is running out. The poor can dine out only so long on illusions. Once they grasp that they've been betrayed, once they match the bleak reality of their future with the fantasies they are fed, once their homes are foreclosed and they realize that the jobs they lost are never coming back, they will react with a fury and vengeance that will snuff out the remains of our anemic democracy and usher in a new Dark Age. Oh my. Uncle Mike's Story Corner, chapter 6912. Tonight's story, Addicted to Nonsense, by one of my favorite writers. I hope he's one of yours, Chris Hedges. Well, now that we're all in a great frame of mind and feel real happy and cheerful, we are about ready to, two people sent that to me today, emailed it to me, and I thought, oh my God, this is just exactly, what we talk about so much on the program, obviously. The only reason I talk about it is because you do and Chris Hedges does, and those of us who still have a mind, we're aware of this. We know what's going on. But Chris Hedges certainly has a way with words, doesn't he? Stick around. We'll be back after this quick break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. Got this email today from George in Oregon, which kind of ties in directly with what Uncle Mike's Story Corner is about tonight. George writes, Mike, my wife turned on the TV this morning to get the weather report. They do manage to get that part right most of the time. And after the initial news report about the four policemen who were gunned down in Tacoma yesterday, came the next item, which was about Tiger Woods smashing up his $60,000 Escalade at 2 o'clock in the morning. I went off. This is news? Who gives an F about Woods smashing up his overpriced SUV? My wife said, you sound just like Malloy. She told me Tom Hartman had been going on about the same thing on his program this morning, so I know I'm in good company. Four police officers are murdered in an apparent ambush, and a BS story about a celebrity is considered a comparable news story. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. What does Woods do? Does he put his life on the line every time he goes to work like those cops did? Does he work the night shift in an ER in East L.A.? Does he volunteer at the local food bank trying to feed people who are destitute because they can't find work? Does he work for the Children's Services Department in a state with a dwindling budget trying to keep kids from being neglected or killed? Those folks aren't news. No, he plays golf. He's a celebrity. This isn't a hit on Woods. The alleged reporters that are hanging out in his driveway should just leave the guy alone. It's a hit on what should be an unimportant triviality that's considered important news by our sorry media. I guess that's where we are, in a celebrity-obsessed society that can't seem to figure out what really matters. The world economy has been robbed blind by the worst bunch of so-called investment banker criminals in history, and we get news stories about celebrities smashing up their SUVs? We have to expand the number of truth seekers, or we really are doomed as a society. Keep raising hell, George in Oregon. Yeah. How many times now have you seen the video, truth seeker, of the happy couple joining the crowd at the dinner for the Indian Prime Minister in the White House? How many times have you seen it? 20? 60? How many times have you heard reports about Tiger Woods just won't fess up to the cops down in Florida and say what was really going on? How were you drinking? Doing little drugs? Got a girlfriend? Come on, America wants to know. Come on, Tig. See, this is the thing. Tiger Woods has been an absolute top-of-the-line brand. Not just a celebrity, but a brand. He has become so popular, so famous, so this, so that. I frankly think golf is a game for idiots, so I don't, you know, pay any attention. I just out of my peripheral vision, I've noticed that Tiger Woods seems like a pretty nice guy, I guess. I don't know. What the hell do I know? I don't know him. Just what I see on the TV. But I do know this from watching other celebrities go down. That crowd that adores Tiger Woods or Oprah Winfrey or whoever the person happens to be, it's a double-edged sword. You let that celebrity flounder or falter, or something comes out and that crowd will be on them like sharks. That's all it takes is one misstep, one thing that the crowd who elevated these people to fame and fortune, one misstep of their celebrity, and they will rip them into a million pieces. And I just wonder, I'm sure the Tiger Woods' advisors understand this and have said to him, Tiger, keep your head down, your mouth shut. Stay out of range of cameras. This too will pass. Well, no, it won't. Because somebody sent me an email with a cover of one of those pukish supermarket tabloids. And all of a sudden, well, there it is. He's got a girlfriend. In the meantime, it was revealed through a Senate report. A real report. You know, why didn't this Senate Foreign Relations Committee, why didn't they investigate 9/11? Why this blue ribbon panel of liars, cheats, sneaks, prevaricators, and cover-ups, you know, issue their report on 9/11, which has now been disavowed by just about everybody on the committee? But the big story, and I swear to God, I did not see it. I did not see it on two network newscasts. And the only reason I know it was on Schuster's program, with Schuster wetting his pants over Representative Hinchy making the statement clearly and concisely about what the Bush crime family did. Why? Why was it not on the NBC News or the ABC News tonight? Why? You know the answer, and so do I. So there it is.
I was talking to somebody today who asked me, has there ever been a time in your life when you felt that the progressives or the liberals or the Democrats, you know, the real ones, not these scum-sucking Democrat lights, not the corrupt Democrats, but where you really thought any time in your life, Malloy, when you felt like the progressive side was winning? And I tried to think, it was the spur of the moment, the question, but I'm sitting there going, well, 60, no, it couldn't be 68, no, 67, no, it couldn't be 67, 60, was it, the 72 elect, no, McGovern seemed to be, no, was it Gene McCarthy, no, was there ever, and then it hit me. No. There has never, ever, ever in my life been a time when I thought, well, with just a little more effort, a little more push, a little more effort, one more street demonstration, one more crowd of 2 million saying no or saying yes, never has there been a time when I thought, you know, we're just about ready to win. Samaritan's Purse charity. You familiar with that? I don't know what kind of work they've done. I used to be fascinated by Billy Graham. Anytime there was a Billy Graham crusade on television, I had to watch it. Especially when I used to get off work at 1 o'clock in the morning here in the East and go home from the radio station. And flip through the channels to come down, dismiss the babysitter. My, at the time, 7-year-old son would be asleep. And I flip through the channels. And I used to watch, I used to love to watch, who is that one that said, "Say baby"? Who is that? Ernest Angley. And then, of course, there was Benny Hinn. You know, I love watching the hustlers. There's something about it that's fascinating. The grifters, the ones who just steal you blind and do it in the name of Jesus. But the Billy Graham crusade was different. I can remember my grandmother listening to the Billy Graham broadcast on Sunday afternoon after church. This is like a million years ago. It's the only time my grandmother turned on the radio because the radio was an instrument of the devil. But she had it in the house for the Billy Graham. All that to say that over the course of my lifetime, I thought that Billy Graham was unique in the televangelists. I don't know what his personal life was like. I know he had made a commitment early on that he would never be in the company of a female without at least a couple of members of his ministry with him. I think his daughter is nuts. I really do. I think she's just flat out insane. And his son Franklin, I think, is just absolutely. I mean, you got to keep in mind where Franklin spent a lot of years doing cocaine and being a real player with the women. You know, I mean, he was a real son of a bitch. Franklin Graham was. He just about sunk Billy into the pits of hell as Billy tried to rescue this reprobate. But then, the old redneck wrote today at Daily Coast, I kind of like this because it tied in with most of what I felt about the whole Graham, Billy Graham ministry, that it was great showmanship. It really was. Oh, Lord have mercy. When he would be in a stadium somewhere, where? Rio de Janeiro, Detroit, London, doesn't make any difference. And he'd be up there and that kind of Western North Carolina drawl that you cannot mock. You can't do that drawl. You have to have been from there. You can't talk like a Western North Carolinian unless you are from there. Do you know that? See, a lot of folks up north think, you know, a Southern drawl. No. There are all sorts of, Southern dialects and tones and pronunciations. But Billy Graham, he'd be up there and, holding open the holy book. Amen. And then he'd issue that call to come down. Now the choir is going to sing, "Near My God to Thee." And all you people up there in the stadium, I want you to come down and accept. You remember that? You've seen that on television, right? Well, I used to watch it. I was fascinated with the power that Billy Graham had. The way he could move people. Oh, good Lord. And they come streaming down out of those bleachers, man. Tears running down their face. Coming down to accept Jesus Christ. And it was really something to see. Now, you know, call me a freak, whatever. But I used to watch that stuff and think, wow. I mean, what am I watching here? Is it mass hysteria? Is it mass hypnosis? Is it a bunch of empty-lived people wanting to get filled up with something? And there's old Billy Graham, who always seemed remote from it. Did you ever notice that? I mean, he was a great preacher. He really was. But he was always disconnected. He was like an automaton standing up there. I never could get a sense of personal feeling from the guy. I had a feeling that when the show was over and the stadium cleared and the lights went out, they would unplug him and put him back in the box until next time. It was weird, 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 weird. And then along came his son, his daughter. I won't even go there, but his son Franklin. This coke-snorting, skirt-chasing, just an absolute some bitch, man. Woo! But as the old redneck pointed out today at Daily Coast, all of a sudden Franklin got the word that, you know, running an evangelistic enterprise was money. Like my friend Jack used to say, there is money in the God business, Mike. My friend Jack, who was from Lafayette, Tennessee. Or no, Lafayette, Georgia. It's right across the state line from Ringgold, Georgia, from Chattanooga. Jack used to say back in the day when we were doing rock concerts and messing around, getting high and stuff, he used to say, you know what we ought to do? We ought to get one of them great big old tents and hire us about 10 people, ex-roadies, you know, from bands that don't on the road anymore, and get us a great big old tent and about 500 folding chairs and hit the dust circuit down here in the South, and you preach, Malloy, and I'll take up the collection. Almost did that. I just thought it was like, yeah, that's a good idea. Anywhere, old Franklin Graham got religion, as the old redneck says, got religion, got forgiven, got saved, and glory hallelujah, he's now head of the Graham family business and the fortune in the zillions. Now, the Graham organization has always had this thing, the Samaritan's Purse. They claim on their website that it's an international Christian relief and evangelism organization that provides spiritual and physical aid to victims of war, poverty, natural disaster, and disease. Of course it is. And an international Christian relief organization, as the old redneck points out, can't function without a fleet of corporate airliners. Right? Gotta have those. And that brings us to Sarah Palin. In her book tour, during the book tour, Palin claims that she's just like the rest of us riding her tour bus. You betcha, from town to town.
which is BS of the highest order. Samaritan's Purse is flying Sarah around in one of its aircraft. She lands near her next book rally, according to the old redneck here, gets on the bus and rides into town on the bus. She is flying around on a Beechcraft King Air 300, tail number N262SP, multi-engine, 11 passenger. The SP does not stand for Sarah Palin. It stands for Samaritan's Purse, which owns the aircraft. That means that donations to Samaritan's Purse are being used to haul Sarah Palin's ass around. I wonder what the donors think of that. Just thought you might like to know. Old redneck finishes up. Does this violate Samaritan Purse's 501c3 status? And get this, he writes, I tried to check the flight activity for the airplane at flightaware.com. The flight activity for this airplane is blocked by the owner. Guess old Franklin doesn't want anyone to know where he's flying and who. This is deceit and lies on so many levels it makes my head hurt. But then what do you expect from a gang of Bible thumpers, right? I'll tell you, Sarah Palin has a plan. And you know what? You know what? People like you and me, especially me, can just mock the hell out of her and just call her everything. What was I calling her last year? The hoe from Wasilla. And just being nasty about this woman. But I want to tell you something, truth seeker. Sarah Palin has been charged by God. And you want to be careful when you start challenging that, right, Malloy? Right.
It's more Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Getting lost here tonight. Really am. A big article in today's New York Times, or yesterday's, I guess it was Sunday's, about food stamps. The use of food stamps is at record highs, climbing every month. And I can remember when food stamps were just looked at by Republicans as a failed welfare scheme or something. And according to the New York Times, it now feeds 1 in 8 Americans. 1 in 8 Americans. And 1 in 4 children. That's a significant statistic. 36 million people now use these little inconspicuous plastic cards. Have you seen them? There was once or twice in my life when I was on food stamps by choice, not out of necessity. And I think I mentioned this once before. Somebody said, well, you're taking food out of really poor people just because you're lazy son of a bitch, you don't want to work. I said, no, that's not how food stamps work. Doesn't work that way at all. But I can remember standing there in the checkout line with the denominations. You had 3 or 4 different books. You had $1 books, $2, fives, and tens, I think. I think that's the way it was. And they would ring it up and then, set aside the things you weren't allowed to buy. And
like, I think at the time, like, you couldn't buy potato chips. Which is, to me, potato chips are like, you know, heroin to a junkie. But then you had to stand there and rip these coupons out. And, you know, I never gave a tinker's damn. You know, what did I care? Here, how many you want? Tell me, how many? But I used to watch some people who would be very furtive about it and just, you know, I can understand that. I really can about food stamps. But about the only thing I give credit to George W. Bush, as opposed to the Bush crime family, was during his administration, he led a campaign to get rid of the program's stigma. And he called food stamps nutritional aid instead of welfare. And he made it easier to apply. That was a bipartisan effort. That was absolutely the opposite in the 1990s when the conservatives, led by Newt Gingrich, the serial adulterer, tried to label people who received food stamps as being, you know, the welfare cheats. You remember Limbaugh used to talk about all the time, the rotten son of a bitch. And they tried to abolish the program. And Congress enacted large cuts and all kinds of hurdles thanks to Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton signed off on all this that would chase people away. Huh? According to New York Times, there are 239 counties in the United States where at least a quarter of the population receives food stamps now. That's according to analysis of local data collected by the Times. The counties are as big as the Bronx in New York, Philadelphia in PA, and as small as Owsley County in Kentucky, where half of the 4,600 residents receive food stamps. And it goes on. In more than 750 additional counties, the program feeds 1 in 3 African Americans. In more than 800 counties, it feeds 1 in 3 children. In the Mississippi River cities of St. Louis, Memphis, and New Orleans, you've heard of those, half the children or more receive food stamps. Peoria, Illinois. You know, will it play in Peoria? Whether it's a play or a new sales pitch or a new product, will it play in Peoria? Every town USA, 40% of children now on food stamps. Are you aware of this? I had no idea. The places where there are 50 small counties and a dozen sizable ones where the rolls have doubled in the last 2 years. In another 205 counties, they've risen by at least 2/3. These places with soaring rolls include Riverside County, California, much of Greater Phoenix, Las Vegas, a ring of affluent Atlanta suburbs not far from where we're broadcasting, a 150-mile stretch of southwest Florida from Bradenton to the Everglades. It's astonishing. Now, as great as those numbers are, nationwide, food stamps only reach about 65% of those who are eligible. The reason more people haven't signed up, I guess, is a matter of pride or ignorance or a combination of both just not understanding the system by ignorance. I mean, ignorance of the system. The system that Bill Clinton, you know, he was the one that reformed welfare, right? Huh? Hey, you did a great job, Billy. You really did. The head of the food stamp program, Undersecretary of Agriculture, Kevin Concannon, said this is the most urgent time for our feeding programs in our lifetime. And with the exception of the Depression, it's time for us to face up to the fact that in this country of plenty, there are hungry people.
yourself with the truth. It's More Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Back to this intriguing article about food stamps in Sunday's New York Times. The thing I like about some of these long pieces that the Times occasionally will do is the fact that the reporters, it's not from an academic point of view. It's from a down in the street, this is what's happening point of view. And the person who put this together, two people, Robert Gebeloff and Jason DeParl for the New York Times, after laying out some facts and figures, they get down to the personal. Like, they go to a corner of southwestern Ohio, which gets my attention because I'm from Ohio. And as they say, it's where red state politics reign and blue-collar workers have often called food stamps a sign of laziness. But guess what? With unemployment off the charts, food stamps use in a six-county area outside Cincinnati has risen more than 50%. Here's an example. With most of his coworkers laid off, Greg Dawson, a third-generation electrician in rural Martinsville, Ohio, considers himself lucky to still have a job. He works a night shift for a contracting firm installing freezer lights in a chain of grocery stores. But when his overtime income vanished and his expenses went up, Mr. Dawson started skimping on meals to feed his wife and five children. He tried to fill up on cereal and eggs. He ate a lot of Spam. Then he went to work with a grumbling stomach to shine lights on food he could not afford. When an outreach worker appeared at his son's Head Start program, Mr. Dawson gave in. "It's embarrassing," he said. He's 29, a taciturn man with a wispy goatee who is so uneasy about the monthly benefit of $300 that he has not told his parents. He says, quote, "I always thought it was people trying to milk the system. But now we just feel like we really need the help." It's not called food stamps anymore, by the way. It's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. 12% of Americans receive aid. 28% of blacks, 15% of Latinos, 8% of whites. Benefits average about $130 per person in the household. Now, Republicans see this as a scam. This rat bastard Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation, whose apparently his views have a following among conservatives, other rat bastards on Capitol Hill, he writes, "Some people like to camouflage this by calling it a nutrition program, but it's really not different from cash welfare. Food stamps is quasi-money." Arguing that aid discourages work and marriage, Food aid discourages work and marriage. Rector said, gotta love his name, said food stamps should contain work requirements as strict as those placed on cash assistance. He says the food stamp program is a fossil that repeats all the errors of the war on poverty. God damn, I hate these people. I hate these people. They are of a different species. They're not like you and me. They're human beings, but they're different species of human being. The Times article says across the country, the food stamp rolls can be read like a scan of a sick economy. The counties of Northwest Ohio, where I'm from, where car parts are made, take sick when Detroit falls ill. Food stamps use is up by 60% in Erie County. 77% in Wood County. That's right next door to Toledo, Ohio. 84% in Van Wert County. I grew up in that area. Go a little further west in Indiana. Elkhart County makes the majority of the nation's recreational vehicles. The RV sales have fallen more than half. And nearly 30% of the county's children are receiving food stamps. And this piece of human waste, Robert Rector of the Heritage Foundation. The food stamp program is a fossil that repeats all the errors of the war on poverty. Wouldn't you like to just hurt him? Okay, maybe you don't, but I'd like to. In Southwest Florida, it's the housing bust. Foreclosure rates in Fort Myers leading the nation the last 2 years. Across six contiguous counties from Manatee, Florida to Monroe, Manatee County to Monroe County, the food stamp rolls have more than doubled. The richest counties, and this was interesting, the richest counties in the country are often where the aid is growing fastest. For example, Forsyth County, right not far from here, outside Atlanta, Forsyth County, had the highest household income in the South in 2007. Food stamps use there now has more than doubled. And as the Times says, this is the first recession in which a majority of the poor in metropolitan areas live in the suburbs. This is not some inner city. This is not Reagan's disdainful little comments about black welfare queens, right? Huh? The suburbs. Use of food stamps has grown by half or more in dozens of suburban counties from Boston to Seattle, including such bulwarks of modern conservatism as California's Orange County, where the rolls are up more than 50%. Orange County, California. You know, a really evil son of a bitch would get on his radio program, if he had one, and say, well, you know, anybody who's ever denigrated food stamps should not be allowed to get them. Of course, I wouldn't say that. Across the 10 core counties in the Mississippi Delta, 45% of black residents receive aid. In a city as big as St. Louis, the share is 60% of African Americans. Use among children is up. A third of the children in Louisiana, Missouri, and Tennessee receive food aid. A third. In the Bronx, New York, the rate is 46%. In East Carroll Parish, Louisiana, 75% of the children receive food stamps. Are you listening, folks? Huh? And Barack Obama is going to come up with a plan tomorrow to spend 30, 40, 50 billion more in that goddamn war. Huh? Isn't that great? Sarah and Tyrone Mangold started the year on track to make $70,000. She was selling health insurance, and he was working on heating and air conditioning crew. She got laid off in the spring, and he got laid off a few months later. Together, they had one unemployment check and a blended family of three children, including one with a neurological disorder, aggravated by, poor nutrition. They ate at his mother's house twice a week. They pawned jewelry. She scoured the food pantries. He scrounged for side jobs. Their frustration peaked one night over a can of pinto beans. Each blamed the other when that was all they had to eat. Mrs. Mangold said, "We were really being snippy, having anxiety attacks. People get irritable when they're hungry." Now food stamps fortify the family income by $623 a month. And the husband, who is still patching together odd jobs, no longer objects. He said, quote, "I always thought people on public assistance were lazy, but it helps me to know now that I can feed my kids," end quote. Isn't that amazing? I'm not dumping on these people. I'm just saying, isn't it amazing how you can just stomp the hell out of somebody when they're down, but buy and just insult them? "Oh, you goddamn welfare recipient. Food stamps. Why don't you get off your ass and get a job?" Right? Isn't that easy? Doesn't that happen? And then all of a sudden, when it's their children whose very survival depends on food stamps, "Well, we're okay now." Change your mind a little bit, didn't it, sport? Fannie and Sean Wardlow, whose house in nearby Oregonia, Ohio, conjures middle American stability rather than the struggle to meet basic needs. Their three daughters have heads of neat blonde hair, pink bedroom curtains, and a turtle bought in better times on vacation at Daytona Beach. One wrote a fourth grade story about her parents that concluded, quote, "They lived happily ever after," end quote. Miss Wardlow, who worked at a nursing home, lost her job first. Soon after, Mr. Wardlow was laid off from the construction job he had held for nearly 9 years. As Ms. Wardlow tells the story of the subsequent fall, cut off threats from the power company, dinners of egg noodles, a soap from the Salvation Army,
She dwells on one unlikely symbol of the security she lost. Pot roast. I was raised on eating pot roast, she said. Just a nice, decent meal. Can't do it anymore. Mr. Wardlow, he's only 32, a strapping man with a friendly air. He talked his way into a job at an envelope factory, although the boss said he was overqualified, but it pays less than what he made muscling a jackhammer. With Miss Wardlow still jobless, they are 2 months behind on the rent, and a monthly food stamp benefit of $429 fills the shelves and puts on the Sunday table an occasional pot roast. Interestingly, you know, that appeared on Sunday in the Times, and Josh Holland, writing alternate, publishes it. What's the date today? Is this the 30th? Today, 30th? I guess Josh published this yesterday about, you know, U.S. economy has shed, in the past 2 years, almost 8 million jobs, the biggest hit to the labor market since the Second World War. Unemployment is now over 10%. The actual number rises to more than 18% when you include those people underemployed against their will, you know, working free, part-time or freelancing, all this other garbage that passes to try to patch together income. And the really horrific part, I think, since we live where we live and our system is what it is, American households have lost $14 trillion in wealth in the real estate and stock market since the beginning of this madness. $14 trillion. And then he writes, against that backdrop of very real pain, I want you to consider what kind of person would sit down as John J. Miller did for the National Review and write something like this about food stamps, which are currently helping feed one of every four American children. Here's what this rat bastard wrote. Quote, seems like there ought to be a stigma attached to the use of welfare. A little bit of shame can go a long way toward encouraging people to find jobs. The federal government may think it's doing people a favor by providing them with access to food, but it's doing them a disservice if it also robs them of the motivation necessary to break free from dependency. You son of a bitch. That's a different species, man. I'm not related to that bastard. I am not related. I may have some genetic structure similar to his, but he's a different species from me. So the incentive needed to get people up off their lazy asses and go find one of those non-existent jobs? An empty belly. Because we all know a hungry child is an alert child, right? Josh writes, allow me to point out that John J. Miller, the guy who wrote that piece of dreck, lives off the handouts of hard right cranks and wealthy ideologues. He writes for the National Review, which has never turned a profit. William Buckley once said that National Review had lost over $25 million over the years. Miller's latest book was a peon to a big money right-wing foundation, published by another big money right-wing foundation. Perhaps, Josh writes, if there were a bit of stigma attached to being a clown who earns his keep off of wingnut welfare, it would discourage Miller from being so dependent on the generosity of others. Parasite. There are people in the society who write things like that. Seems like there ought to be a stigma attached to the use of welfare. Get off your ass and go get a job. Where are you, bastard? Where? Where's the factory worker? Where's so-called working class America? Where are they going to find jobs with the effective unemployment rate hovering around 20%? Man, this insulated prick sits in an office of National Review writing stuff like this. Man, I'll tell you, the day is coming, and you know this as well as I do. You know this. You know it's coming because I think we crossed over some. We crossed over the that little balance point on the seesaw of despair and poverty and the mega wealthy, where 1% of the people in this country now have more wealth than the bottom 90%. I mean, when you get to a ratio like that, the society is open and ripe for revolution. You know it, and I know it. I don't want to advocate it because I think to myself, all the people who will die, all the systems that are going to be utterly and absolutely destroyed, everything that everybody in this country has ever worked for, not right-wingers, screw them. They never worked for anything in this country. But what decent people, not Republicans, what decent people have worked for in this country is going to be blown away. And you know it. You know this is coming. You know it's coming. And you do what I do? I ignore it. Except when I do this radio program, I ignore it. I will not think about it. I will not allow myself to focus on this. Because if I do, then I couldn't do it. If I were not married, or let me rephrase it, if I didn't have a 5-year-old, I might focus on it. And it might drive me crazy, but because I have a 5-year-old, I don't dare think about this stuff. I can't. Because until I die, Molly depends on me and Kathy. And I can't, I can't focus on all this stuff that's going on out here, all this destruction to a society that I grew up believing was real. All those ideals, all those, you know, do a good job, work hard. Everything will be okay. Everything works out because you live in the United States of America, not realizing that these capitalist sons of bitches were plotting and planning every single move to utterly and absolutely destroy me, destroy you, destroy the working class, destroy the middle class after all the hard work that went into producing it. And these greedy, miserable sons of bitches couldn't have cared less. It's hard, isn't it? It's hard not to give up that idea of hope, that idea of, hey, things are going to work out. You know, we got to turn this around. Hey, this huge ship, this is an oil tanker, and it takes a long time to turn an oil tanker. We're not a skidoo. It takes a while. You still believe that? Jamie writes, Mike, you usurped all those conservabots by answering your call for one good thing a Republican has ever done in recent years to help out regular folks, and that is reducing the stigma of food stamps and making it easier to apply for the program. Of course, the damage done by the economic destruction of the Bush years overwhelms this tiny improvement in the perception of the program. So I just had a sad chuckle over this one, Jamie. Yeah. But you see, right-wingers, Republicans, people who monitor this program, even they're too stupid to realize that it was George W. Bush who said, hey, it's not welfare, it's nutrition.
back. It is about 7 past the hour. This is the Beloit program. Third hour. We're almost home. Stick around. Irish Dave writes, Mike, you know, food stamps, the kind where you had to tear them out of the book, were printed by the Bureau of Printing and Engraving. Now, however, the credit card type, the SNAP program used in Nevada, has a transaction fee that goes to Citibank. So maybe George Bush's motives were not as pure as I thought, right? It's not just the right wingers and the Republicans who demonize people that accept food stamps until they have to take them, but also a lot of preachers in this country, these prosperity bastards, these preachers who, if I were Jesus, I would reach down out of heaven and pinch their goddamn heads off and toss them into hell where the demons could use them as soccer balls. But I don't have that power. But I despise these televangelists, these preachers. John Hagee, is that his name? John, who makes, I guess, a lot of appearances on the Suiciders program, Glenn Beck. Here's Hagee on food.
In the Bible says the man that does not work should not eat. I still think that ought to be the law in the United States of America. If you don't want to get up off your blessed assurance and go to work, starve! I don't care! Starve! I don't feel sorry for you! Go to work!
All right, pause it right there. Well, that's nice. There's one of those voices of Jesus. Huh? There he is, Pastor John Hagee. Yeah. I don't care. Starve, you rotten son of a bitch. Starve. What did Jesus do, Pastor John? He took a bunch of fish and some loaves and fed the multitude. You remember that? Those people didn't fish. They weren't bakers. You lard-ass bastard. Play it again, Kathy. Can you cue it up and play it again? This is a man of Jesus. This
That's
is...
in the mail.
Listen.
In the Bible says the man that does not work should not eat.
Oh.
I still think that ought to be the law in the United States of America. If you don't want to get up off your blessed assurance and go to work, starve!
Oh.
I don't care! Starve!
Yeah.
I don't feel sorry for you.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's great. You and Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck and the cokehead Franklin Graham and the rest of you swine. Huh? Starve! I don't feel sorry for you. God damn it, I eat. I got lots of money coming in. Send me more. Here, you want a prayer cloth? My God, how did we produce this? How did we do this? How did the society cause these religious predators? They're ghouls. They work their way through society eating the sick and the scared and the poor and the hopeless. They eat them. They take huge bites out of them. They're ghouls. Here, let me eat on you for a minute. I'll show you the way to heaven. And then the financial predators. Here's a house for you. Don't worry about it. 10% interest. Of course, it's going to reset in 3 years, but we don't care what your credit history is. Here, sign here. Isn't it? Look at this. It's got granite countertops. Here you go. God damn it, everybody needs granite countertops. Here you go. Sign up. Go ahead, dumbass. Sign up. You want to work? You want to work in a factory? You want to be a drop forge operator? What are you going to forge? What's your forge going to drop? I mean, what are you talking about? Those jobs are gone. You want to go to work? Here, I got a job for you. I want you to come over here and stuff envelopes. You what? You did factory work for 22 years. You can take this envelope stuffing job, or there's the door, fella. What are you talking about? How much we pay? $6.50 an hour. How's that? Way above minimum wage, isn't it? Huh? Huh? You want a job? How did this happen? How did this happen? Does anybody know how this happened? Hello? Can I see some hands? 1% of the population in this country controls more wealth than the bottom 90%. Oh, I realize there's a gap of 8% in there. But that 1% controls more than 90% of the rest of us. Son of a bitch! How much longer is that going to go on? When is the 1% going to control more than 99% of the rest of us? Where's the tipping point? Anybody know? Where's the point where Americans say, okay, that's it, the experiment's over, and they pick up a club and say the society's going to change. I'm tired of this. When? When's it going to happen? Huh? When's it going to happen? I get my pickup truck and I can drive around suburban Atlanta, or I can go into Atlanta, and I don't see any additional number of homeless. We had the Georgia Tech game here yesterday. Big deal, right? Georgia Tech. Ah, damn. And Kathy and I were trying to get someplace. I forget where. We had Molly in the back seat, and we got on 7585 going into downtown Atlanta. Dead stop, parking lot. Look at all these cars. Look at all these Georgia flags and Georgia Tech flags, and good old boys now in their 40s and 50s hanging out the door, drinking, swilling beer, and carrying on. Hey, I damn, you know, go Tech, go Dogs. And I look at that and I think, wait a second, I thought we were all on food stamps. I thought the economy was crashing. I thought we were involved in two wars. I thought unemployment's 18, 19, 20%. Go Dogs! I'm confused, man. I am absolutely, utterly confused. Jesus Christ, I wish I could be like Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh and have all the answers and millions of dollars. God damn, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't you like to be that? I would sooner cut my own throat than go there. Get these emails. Well, how many radio stations are you on? I can't say. Well, not many. 20, 22, 23 maybe. I got to update our list on the website. I don't know. Tomorrow night, before 8 o'clock Eastern, Barack Obama is going to make his case for sending another 35,000 American men and women into Afghanistan. And he's got an hour of prime time to let the American people know that his ass is not going to be kicked by anybody who lives in caves and herds goats. Nuh-uh. Of course, the people of Afghanistan don't necessarily live in caves, do they? But Obama is going to make his bones tomorrow night. Then he becomes a war president. The simple order of another 35 or 40,000. The troop numbers went up earlier in Obama administration, but those had already been committed. These are his. These are his. This is where President Obama gets to play with the lead soldiers, huh? Just like I did. How about you? When you were a kid, remember those little metal? No, they weren't metal. What were they? Stone. They had a fire under them, and you put the lead in there and melt them down. You take some of them soldiers and put it in and melt them down. We played with that stuff, you know. God only knows why we all didn't die of cancer. But and then you pour them into the molds and let them sit. And sometimes, if you were in a hurry, it'd pour some cold water over them and then open them up, and bingo, you got lead soldiers. Well, now it's Barack Obama's turn. Barack Obama probably did not play with lead soldiers. I would imagine by the time he was 8 or 9 years old, long before that, they realized that playing with lead was not particularly a good idea for young boys and girls back in the day. And besides, Barack Obama went to Harvard and lived in Indonesia and grew up in a fairly solid middle-class background, didn't he, huh? I doubt if he played with lead soldiers. We played with them because, well, it was cheap. But tomorrow night, Barack Obama gets to play commander-in-chief. Wouldn't it be great if Barack Obama would, standing in West Point tomorrow night, say, look, I made a decision. I'm bringing him home. I'm bringing every soldier home now. She read the magazine and the moon rose over an open field. I'm empty and aching and I
Frivolity with Mike Malloy.
Anyway, as Barack Obama makes his decision tomorrow night, or I'm sure the decision has been made, but reveals to the American public what that decision is, and then we have the subsequent criticisms develop, and of course, finding those 30,000 soldiers, 35,000, where they're going to come from, but that's all a operational problem, has nothing to do with you and me, because we're not involved in the war. We're not involved at all. And I don't think you and I could really come up with a logical reason as why any of us are involved, but there we are. So forget about logic and reason. We're talking war. But what kind of a situation is Barack Obama sending in troops where it concerns what those troops would be fighting for? Who are we fighting for? Are we fighting to defend the government of Hamid Karzai against these boogeymen, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda? Is that what we're doing? To defend the government that's there, this corrupt, filthy government, just like the corrupt, filthy government of South Vietnam, that we defended until we got tired of it and then assassinated the poor bastard that ran South Vietnam. And, of course, the retribution from the military-industrial complex was to assassinate John F. Kennedy 4 months later. But who are we defending? What are we trying to do? Are we there to impose democracy, Western-style democracy? If that is the case, that is madness, complete insanity. Of course, that's not a news flash, that it's madness and insanity, but why are we there? Our military affairs correspondent, Sharon, sent me this dispatch from Reuters in Kabul. Rape in Afghanistan is a human rights program of profound proportions, the United Nations said today. Profound proportions. The United Nations Human Rights Representative in Afghanistan said field research conducted late last year and early this year found rape affected all parts of Afghanistan across all communities and social groups. Nora Nyland, the commissioner, the representative, said at a news conference in Kabul, quote, women and girls are at risk of rape in their homes, in their villages, and in detention facilities. It is a human rights problem of profound proportions, end quote. Ms. Nyland said that feelings such as shame exacerbate the problem, often attached to victims rather than perpetrator. The victim is a shame, not the perpetrator. Obama is sending 36,000 more troops into this? Rape occurs, according to the report, within the family and beyond, and victims are often prosecuted for committing adultery. Huh? How about that? The victim is prosecuted for committing adultery after she has been raped. How about that? During Afghanistan's civil war of the early 1990s, rape and sexual violence towards women was widespread, and Islamist Taliban militants gained strength at first because of their tough stance against the crime. Women's rights in Afghanistan improved markedly since the 2001 overthrow of the strict Sunni Islamist Taliban government, which prohibited women from working, attending school, or leaving their homes without a male relative. However, Afghanistan remains a deeply conservative Muslim religious society, particularly in remote areas where cultural and tribal laws often supersede civil laws. You see, a deeply conservative, they have the word Muslim here, but I'll put in the word religious. So therefore, rape? What rape? What are you talking about, Malloy? There's no such thing as rape. I own the bitch. I own her. They own the bitch. Because it's religious. Ms. Nyland said, democracy and peace in Afghanistan is dependent
on the elimination of violence and the full participation of women, as well as men, of course, in decision-making processes that affect their lives and the future of the nation. That will not happen, and you know that will not happen. That will never happen. This is a tribal society that has been around for millennia. Their women are like their animals. Their farm animals, their goats, whatever the hell their farm animals are. It says so in the mighty holy Quran, as it says in the mighty holy Bible, as it says so in just about every religious text. The woman? The woman? The woman? The creature that unleashed hell because she ate of the fruit? Of the fruit of the tree? Are you talking about her? Rights? Rape? What are you talking about? She's a woman.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come.
When heartburn.
Time to practice your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
Oh my! Oh, listen. If you live in the Los Angeles area, I realize that KTLK right now still has a football game going on. But for those of you who listen via Sirius or XM or the internet, if you live in in L.A. area, there's a World March for Peace and Nonviolence Wednesday, December 2nd, 6 p.m. Day after tomorrow, 6 p.m. Wednesday, December 2nd at Wilshire. They're going to meet up at Wilshire and Alvarado, MacArthur Park. And if you attend the march, please take a flashlight. The march will start there, MacArthur Park, and end at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, where there will be live speakers and music. And if you want some more information, go to this website, kpfk.org, K-P-F-K, kpfk.org. All right? If you're in the L.A. area, Wednesday night. It's a march for peace and nonviolence. That's a little bit different from having a million people show up in D.C. and demand an end to, trying to prevent the invasion of Iraq. Go to kpfk.org and you'll get the information. It's tomorrow, Wednesday night, 6 p.m., Wilshire and Alvarado, MacArthur Park. That's where the march will start. It'll end at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. Okay? And if you don't live in the LA area, send them some love, as they say, you know? Peace and nonviolence. What a concept. Now, the President of the United States tomorrow night will make an announcement about war and violence. And here's a group of people in Los Angeles who will march from MacArthur Park to Emmanuel Presbyterian in honor of peace and nonviolence. Isn't that the juxtaposition of that is just astonishing, isn't it? This is a great country. You can have a leader who advocates war and destruction and death. A leader that's supposed to be a progressive Democrat, right? Somebody we all got off our asses and said, hey, look, look, oh my God. Let's vote for him. Listen to him. Oh, listen. Oh, I can't wait till he's elected. He'll stop this, right? And he won the Nobel Peace Prize. Yeah. So tomorrow night he announces more death and destruction and war and violence. And then later on, in about a week or so, he heads to Oslo to pick up his
What do they give him? They get a little statuette, like Grammy Awards? No, you don't get that? What do you get? Little citation? Little something to put up on the wall at home? Am I being a cynical son of a bitch tonight? I sure am. I just can't stand this. I can't stand this. Hey, Mr. President, you won the Nobel Peace Prize. God damn it. P-E-A-C-E. Can you spell? Yes, you can. You went to Harvard. Yale? I don't know. Harvard. There you go. President of the Law Review or the editor or whatever the hell it is. I don't know. I'm not that educated. I'm not. I have no idea. Harvard Law Review, is that what it is? Okay, and what's it? You're an educated man who won the Peace Prize, and tomorrow night you are going to order another 36,000 into Kipling wrote about the area that you're sending troops into. And Kipling wrote about the utter futility. Kipling, the great British imperialist, still realized when the jig was up. Still realized that there are certain places that the British Raj was not going to take root. Afghanistan. But you're an educated man, Mr. President. You know a hell of a lot more than I do. But I tell you what, there's a bunch of people who are going to be marching tomorrow night, Wednesday night, from MacArthur Park to a Presbyterian church in L.A., downtown L.A. They're marching for peace and nonviolence. That's all. Just marching for peace and nonviolence. That's all. Just, you know, let's march for peace. Bring a flashlight if you show up, okay? Bring a flashlight to light your way. Corner of Wilshire and Alvarado, Wednesday night, 6 p.m. And if you want more information, go to kpfk.org. Reminds me of a friend up in Seattle, Jude, who stands for peace. Stands for peace. You've heard that expression. What do you stand for? I stand for peace. She carries combat boots. A pair of combat boots, military combat boots. Out of the combat boots sticks a flower. She stands for peace. She won't be in L.A. marching from MacArthur Park to Emmanuel Presbyterian, but I'll guarantee that someplace, somewhere tomorrow, if you're driving around, if you see this woman, blonde woman, standing there, she's blonde. You see this blonde woman standing on a corner someplace. She's slim, wears a coat, because it's nasty weather out there in Seattle. But she'll be standing out there someplace with these combat boots and a flower sticking out of them. If you see her, honk, wave. Don't give her the finger. Come on now. Come on now. Be nice. Just honk and wave. If you're in L.A. and not real busy tomorrow, Wednesday night at 6 p.m., go take your flashlight and march from MacArthur Park to Emmanuel Presbyterian. Don't forget your flashlight. You don't have to carry combat boots or flowers. Just take your flashlight. You want to do that? Huh? Oh, Lord, have mercy. What else we got? Oh, yeah, an expert from MIT. Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, did a study. Jonathan Gruber, an economist, and came to the conclusion that the health insurance reform bill being pushed by Obama and the Democrats will result in Americans buying individual coverage and paying less than they do now for a typical individual market coverage, and would be protected from high out-of-pocket costs, Americans. So Democrats will argue that under the Senate bill, Americans would pay less and get more. The new document arms Democrats with a response to pieces of human waste like Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, that the bill would mean higher premiums, higher taxes, massive cuts to Medicare. God damn, the Negro in the White House is going to destroy everything. That's Mitch McConnell. The analysis is by Jonathan Gruber, an economist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a Treasury Department official under Clinton. Gruber used data from the Congressional Budget Office. The study is available if you want to take a look at it. Just go to a Google on Jonathan Gruber, G-R-U-B-E-R, Jonathan Gruber. You'll find it. But I didn't hear that on the evening news tonight either. Along with a whole lot of other stuff, didn't hear. Did you hear Amy Goodman? Democracy Now! Busted or detained at the Canadian border and questioned about why she was going into Canada? Huh? And apparently got... She tried to cross into Canada. People don't need visas to go there. They just, you know, they just, you need to show identification. I guess now, thanks to the Bush administration, you got to show your passport to get back in. But you need your passport. You ought to have your passport. Hell, if you go to the grocery store, take your passport. She said, we were very surprised. She said, we pulled into the border facility. It's a large hangar-like space. And they started going through our car. But we're inside, and then the Border Patrol called me to the counter, and the guard said, you need to show some identification. You need your passport. I go up the counter, and the guard says, I want your notes. And Amy said, my notes? And the Canadian guy said, yeah, the notes for the talk tonight. She was on her way to give a speech at where? Someplace, Vancouver Public Library. She was driving up from Seattle. And the guy said, we want your notes. My notes? The notes for your talk tonight. She writes, I was completely taken aback. I went out to the car and I brought in the copy of Breaking the Sound Barrier. That's her book. And I came in and I said, well, this is my new book and it's a book of columns. So I actually read from the columns. And the Canadian guy said, I want the notes. And she said, well, these you can think of as my notes. And he said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, I actually start with the last column, which is, it's a column about Tommy Douglas. Now, for people in the United States, you know, Tommy Douglas is the premier, was the premier of Saskatchewan who pioneered the Canadian national healthcare system. So I said, I'll be talking about Tommy Douglas. And he said, what else? And I said, what else? Well, global warming. Oh, it gets better. Stick around. I'll give you the rest of it when we come back. This is Amy Goodman, Busted. Busted at the Canadian border when she was trying to make her way to a speech to be given at the Vancouver Public Library. The Border Patrol, or whatever it's called in Canada, took her in, started asking her questions. Anyway, she's asked for her notes for her speech by the Canadian Border Patrol. And she said, well, I don't have notes. I'll go get my book. So she went out and got her book. And she said, well, you know, these are my notes because this is a book of my columns, and I actually start with one of these columns, and that's my speech. And I start with this last column, which is a column about Tommy Douglas. And again, for people who don't know, as I didn't until I heard about this, he was the former premier of Saskatchewan who brought who pioneered Canadian national health care system. And interestingly, here's a little bit of tabloid. He's the grandfather of actor Kiefer Sutherland. His father, of course, is Donald Sutherland. And see how tight these circles are? And Amy Goodman says, so I'll be talking about Tommy Douglas. And they were actually at what is called the Douglas border crossing. And the guard said, so what else? And she said, what else? Well, global warming. And he said, what else? And she said, well, the global economic meltdown. What else? He said, well, I'll also be talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. What else are you talking about? He said. And there was another customs agent, a group of them with the border guard. I mean, they're armed, Amy says. Another border guard now has her book and he's reading it. But they're also inputting everything I say. This border guard is handwriting all the notes about what I say. And when the other border guard is, then the other border guard is going to the computer and inputting everything. And then they say, what else? And I say, that's about it. And the guard says, what about the Olympics? And I said, the Olympics? You mean when President Obama went to Copenhagen and pushed for the Olympics to come to Chicago? And he said, and you didn't get them. And she said, or I said, I know we didn't get them. And he said, no, I'm talking about the Olympics here in 2010 in Canada. And I said, no, I didn't plan on talking about the Olympics. You're denying that you're talking about the Olympics? Amy Goodman said, that's not my topic, right? It's not so much news in the United States. I really didn't know what he was referring to, and he kept pushing. He was clearly incredulous, and at my surprise, he disbelieved me even further. He clearly did not think I was telling the truth. He kept pushing. You're denying you're talking about the Olympics? And I said, that wasn't my plan for tonight. And of course, as the reporter had asked me, and if you said yes, what would have happened then? Anyway, the guard finally tells me to sit down, and they go out and they comb through the car. I got very alarmed at what was happening, and I walked outside to where the guards were going through the car. One is on my colleague's computer as if it was his. You know, he's just, the computer was set up, and there he was going through it. They were rifling through my papers and everything. They told me to get back inside, so I went back inside. Finally, they came in. We're now over an hour and a half late to the talk, and they say for me to follow them into a back room. I go with them into a back room, the border guards, and they take my picture. They make four copies of the picture. They take my traveling companion, Dennis and Chuck's pictures, individually, one by one. They take us back, one by one. And then they attached them to what they called a control document. I said I wasn't aware we needed a visa. And they said, these are control documents. And they stapled them into each of our passports. And I opened it, and it said the control document that we had to leave by Friday. We were coming on Wednesday. We had to leave by Friday. And then we were allowed to leave. We saw that they had been through both of my colleagues' computers, both Dennis and Chuck's computers. I don't know if they got into mine, and they'd gone through the car, and we eventually arrived an hour and a half late to the talk. So, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio. Harassed as if she were coming into this country rather than going out by Canadian border guards. Who do you suppose suggested that Amy Goodman be treated that way? Whose idea was it? Do you think it was just, some border guard in Vancouver? Eh? Do you? You think so? You think it was just somebody who wanted to prove he had a penis that particular day, and here was a woman traveling with a couple of guys? I'll be a tough son of a bitch here. You think? That would be the easy answer, wouldn't it? Well, just some crazy-ass border guard who ran out of Viagra a couple nights ago and was just angry about it. You think? Or was it something more sinister? This is what the United States does to writers from Central and South America. If you're a Cuban poet or a Venezuelan writer or a Chilean and you want to come to this country and you espouse democratic socialism, you ain't getting in. Not even now. Not even with the great Barack Obama as president. Sorry. Rules are rules and they must be followed. But Canada? Canada? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Why so?